we'll get started. My name is Kevin Van Meter. I'm an activist and organizer and student from Long Island, New York. Glorious suburbs, and I hope there's other suburban activists around because there seems to be too few of us. Today I'll be presenting on a subject called, and sorry to change the title. When I originally gave Cindy this, this title was back in May, and what I had done at that point is just really begin my research into the subject matter. And as it's titled, Everyday Resistance, a Strategy Under Slavery in Peasant Societies and on the Factory Floor. And to kind of modify that, because I'll also be talking about the social factory, and I think part of what I'll be discussing also is a signpost to further research, analysis, and strategy for the fact that what I'll be doing in talking about the everyday resistance of these four groups of folks, I'm really creating signposts. Unfortunately, the information that I'm dealing with is not complete. I'm not formulating these ideas with a full deck because the research has not been properly done. And as the, you know, you'll see how my opening comments here apply throughout the rest of the material. But I will be primarily discussing forms of struggle, forms of everyday resistance, and its relation to revolutionary strategy. Just briefly, this came out of a discussion that I had last summer here at the Institute of Social Ecology. I'm an ISE student through Burlington College getting my bachelor's, and this discussion came primarily out of a conversation that happened here last summer at the ENC program, the Ecology and Community. And actually, I presented on a related topic in December with a professor, Conrad Herold, who's an autonomist, called Anarchism, Direct Democracy, and Multiplicity, using direct democracy to approach and discuss multiplicity, which I will briefly touch on. Additionally, what you see here is a reaction to a piece that was written by Harry Cleaver. It can be found in Anarchist Studies and online on his website. It's called Kropotkin, Self-Valorization and the Crisis of Marxism. And what that basically is Cleaver comparing the concept of self-valorization, which is an autonomous concept developed in Italy by Negri and others, to that of mutual aid. And what I am considering everyday resistance is actually a melding of the two concepts. It really is a takeoff from what Cleaver has done. But generally, what I'm doing here is developing a concept. See, this is one concept among many concepts. I'm not saying this is the be-all, end-all of revolutionary strategy, but I'm just adding this to our, I guess you would say, collection of different concepts, and hopefully expanding upon mutual aid and other relationships. Also, this is coming out of why we haven't been successful as revolutionaries. I think one of the major problems that I've been addressing lately, theoretically, is why we haven't been successful. I think that's probably a question. I'm sorry.
Do you want to interrupt? Can you at some point explain what self-valorization is?
I'm getting to it. Some of the concepts that I do mention, if you are not familiar with them, just kind of nod, and I'll do my best to explain them. Why we haven't been successful, and I think it's due primarily to our approach as revolutionaries, and that comes really to the heart of what everyday resistance is, for the fact, even though it's an assumption within anarchism that people are resisting against capital, against the state, against different forms of domination, unfortunately the concept has not been really fully articulated or developed. So what I'm doing is I'm not looking at the at folks who are not resisting. I'm not looking at a from an anarchist perspective on a population that is just completely subordinated to capital and the state. I'm looking at a population that's already resisting in everyday forms, and that is a basis for other strategy and development. So basically, my conclusion to begin with that is that we should be organizing people who are resisting and organizing their already existing resistances rather than organizing people to resist. And I would just lay out one initial model, and this also is the first time I'm presenting on this, so if it's a little rocky, I apologize. But I see primarily, and I'll get out of the way, overt rebellion, or what we are commonly called protest movements, other actions are what I see as tip of the iceberg to actually what is happening in society. The primary form of organizing for the majority of the world's population throughout history has been everyday resistance. That's how they've resisted the system. They haven't had the privilege, as many of us have, to actually articulate, to participate in overt rebellions and overt political activities. And to quote James Scott, who's one of the major folks that I've taken information from and worked with, I worked with his material and findings in a book that he wrote called Weapons of the Weak, Everyday Forms of Peasant Resistance, which I believe is out there for sale. And to quote Scott, formalized, organized political activity, even revolutionary, is typical the preserve of the middle class and intelligentsia. To look for peasant politics in this realm is largely to look in vain. So if we look throughout labor history, we look throughout the history of peasant societies, throughout slavery, up until really the 60s, most of the focus, and continuing today, unfortunately, has been, you know, this section. Who's resisting? Who knows, you know, what is their consciousness? What is going on? And not really looking at what I would consider, you know, the peaks of rebellion and the lulls. What's going on in this section? What is, you know, creating these peaks? What is furthering these peaks? What are making these peaks possible? And this is the everyday resistance. To go on, as I just mentioned, what I'm doing here is really expanding the thesis of others. Thus far, there's been a lot of work by Herbert Aptheker, George Rawick, two autonomists, who are both now quite elderly. I believe Rawick has passed. On the issue of everyday resistance and slavery. Herbert Aptheker, for one, what's the name of his... apologize. The name of his text. American Negro Slave Revolts, which came out in the 60s, was very useful to the civil rights era and in the civil rights movement in looking at what slaves were doing. They weren't passive, they weren't accepting of the order, and primarily their form was not overt rebellion, but everyday resistance. James Scott and others have been looking into the peasant societies and everyday resistance there, and folks familiar with the autonomists, with Rawick as well, looking into the social industrial factory, especially around the autonomous movement in Italy. A lot of those folks have been working on that. And this also comes out with an internal debate within Marxism. I guess you would call the action versus consciousness debate. Those Marxists who are not looking at necessarily the correct ideology of the population, of the oppressed classes, but actually looking at their action, what they're doing. And I think this is definitely a debate that we could bring into our own ranks and discuss within anarchism. Just briefly to define self-valorization for the gentleman on the left and to show its relation with mutual aid. Self-valorization, very briefly, because I could really, this is a subject matter that we could discuss in a workshop. Self-valorization is the people's definition of self-needs that are outside and autonomous to capital. And the way I see overt of everyday resistance as two things, as mutual aid and as self-valorization. For instance, to kind of lay this out in an example, I sneak out of work to spend a half an hour in the bathroom. I'm creating my my space outside of capital. I'm self-valorizing. I'm creating my own value, my own space. In order for this to happen, there needs to be a conspiracy of silence, mutual aid among my colleagues and fellow workers, because if they go and rat on my ass, then this time was used completely in vain. So in a sense, and it'll come out in the specific forms I discuss and how the commonality of forms between slavery, peasant societies, and in the industrial and social factory work out. And this is primarily the model. At times, you know, mutual aid is dominant. At times, self-valorization is dominant. But I'm seeing these, as Cleaver does, as two sides of the same coin in everyday resistance. To read briefly, what I'm calling these folks who are resisting on an everyday basis are silent guerrillas. Just to read briefly from the paper that I'm presenting on, the silent guerrilla is everywhere and always, in the depths of the prison, in the memories of slave stories, in the rice paddies, sweating over stoves in suburbia, sitting in classrooms abound, standing behind fast food counters, and toiling under artificial lights in industrial factories. This is no mythic figure conjured up for propaganda purposes, but a powerful social actor in the struggle for space outside and against capital. The trains which the silent killer wages war are off the radar screen of the oppressor, below the union, out of sight of the political party or the grassroots organization, and more underground than the temporary autonomous zone, and yet powerful enough to change the course of history and improve the conditions under which they live, immediately and with little deviation. The silent guerrillas do not have access to power, to the political stage, to overt rebellion, and to organize political activity. The silent guerrilla plays on the plane of everyday resistance, that of infrapolitics, that of symbol, rumor, and language, that of vestigial communal behaviors, that of criminalized survival. Their targets in general, the imposition of work and the state. Their weapons are numerous. Their purpose is the liberation of space, the separation of life from the control of the spectacle, from the expropriation of surplus value, and the creation of new networks of mutual aid. As we will see, they are everywhere and always. To expand upon that and to discuss everyday resistance, a quick definition before moving forward. Everyday resistance is the activities that were undertaken by slaves, peasants, industrial and social workers, and other oppressed people on a daily basis. Consciously or unconsciously, they either created space or resisted the social order. This includes creating community and communication networks outside the clutches of the social order. Theft, poisoning, arson, running away, feigning illness, mutilation, suicide, strike, and the slowing of work. These general categories will come to light in examination of specific cases of everyday resistance. Also, these silent guerrillas are fighting on different terrains. And to call attention to, and I hope there's somebody in the room from this, the Justice Ecology and Democracy project, which is a community center I guess they're setting up in Maine. And it's very interesting to see the similarities between what I'm doing on Long Island. And it does relate to this presentation in the sense that here, for the first time in an anarchist setting, I've seen the discussion of Deleuze's and Guattari's rhizome as it relates to revolutionary strategy, as well as Paulo Freire's pedagogy and approach. But the rhizome, which is a model, I guess you would say, developed by Deleuze and Guattari, is directly related to these forms of everyday resistance. This is pretty much the underlying theoretical argument for what I'm approaching here. And just briefly, the terrains on which the silent guerrillas are struggling are multiple and everywhere. Guerrillas on the same plane might nod their head to each other to alert the other of their presence, while guerrillas on different planes might pass one another on the street and never know of the other's existence. These planes are always intersecting, cycling, and in a constant state of flux. They are waves from different shores, from above and below, rippling together, sometimes creating typhoons. Other times they pass through one another without effect. The terrains are rhizomatic, and the pressure points are multiple as well. So looking as these different everyday resistances form different terrains that are intersecting, that are developing, that that are existing already within our society, forms, which is as the basic of the rhizome, which are forming these terrains, is that of multiplicity. Multiplicity is a concept also developed by Deleuze and Guattari that is describing the multiplicity of action. I can recommend a number of texts, but since that's not our subject today, you'll kind of see how this what I'm outlining is going to come out when I'm discussing specific forms. Without ado, to move on to the commonality of forms, the different forms of everyday resistance. And you know what I'm saying here and thus far is all well and good, but unless I'm actually backing it up with real data, these formulations will not really assist us in any revolutionary strategy. While thus far this material is engaging and interesting and shows a lot of possibilities for revolutionary strategy, it's worth nothing if it actually doesn't reflect what's really going on. But briefly, to go through the different forms under slavery in peasant societies and in the social industrial factory. To quote George Rawick in his text, The American Slave from Sundown to Sun Up, sundown to sunup and reflecting slaves' own time. He states, under slavery as under any social system, those at the bottom were not totally dominated by the master class. They found ways of subverting the worst of the systems and even at times dominating the masters. To briefly discuss these forms, and I will go through them as fast as I can so that we can have some kind of discussion at the end. And I do apologize if this is kind of rushed, but in 20, 30 minutes to discuss this material is trying. To discuss briefly slavery and the natives' revolt against capitalism. As we see, especially in Brazil, where slavery first poked its ugly head in the modern, quote-unquote, capitalist era, we see the natives revolting on an everyday basis. We see the natives who are trying the conquerors, the capitalists are trying to enslave in these plantations to create agricultural products or to cut down trees that could be shipped back to Europe. In this, we see these plantations being developed very similar to the slave plantations that we're all familiar with. And the everyday resistance, the simple running away, the arson, the murder, the other simple reactions, the simple everyday resistance of the native population forced capital to react in such a general way, what I call a general crisis of capital. For instance, if there was an arson that's a particular crisis of capital, they need to approach the issue of arson, the issue of running away. They enslave these people and they run off. And they enslave these people and they run off. And that's a particular crisis of capital. They have to address that. They have to deal with that. But a general crisis of capital is a crisis within its form of labor. And we see that beginning of slavery as a very interesting example for how everyday resistance can affect the system. So you see these natives running away and creating arson, all kinds of trouble for those who are enslaving them. But in reaction to that, capital needed labor. They needed somebody who were going to work these fields. They needed someone to cut down trees to send back to Europe. So capital's reaction, which is, to think of even to do this today, to go all the way to Africa to enslave people to bring to the United States. And that reaction was forced not by some party, not by some movement, but that reaction was forced by the simple and everyday, collective, but individualized actions of the native population. Why slavery is not a good reaction. We're not looking necessarily at the outcome and capital's reaction to the actions. We're looking at the actions themselves. And these little everyday resistances of the natives enforcing this development of capital shows their strength, shows their power. While the reaction, as I said, is not good, slavery was not a good outcome for these everyday resistances, our concern here is not necessarily reaction of capital. We don't control that. What we do control is our everyday resistances. So that is one example of that, and a very interesting example, being that that is really at the foundation for those who are familiar with the history of capitalism and its development. Looking at slavery is really the creation of wealth, of cycling of wealth into Europe, which formed the basis of industrialization and other things, and slavery is primary in that. And while we're not happy with the development of capital, we are happy with the reaction of the everyday people. And even within Middle Passage, within the trip from Africa to the New World, we see many, many different actions, mutinies, slaves starving themselves, infanticide, them drowning themselves, doing anything they possibly can to resist their forced enslavement, their forced movement from Africa to the New World. Really from the very beginning, there was also, which unfortunately has only really been addressed in reference, but not furthered in any kind of article or book that I have seen, is the resistance to slaves to being enslaved, the actual process of enslaving. They're being brought over, they're resisting at that point, they're resisting on the auction block when slaves are being sold, and this arm is not working too well. Well, you're driving down the costs, you're driving down the price that slave is going to be sold for. So all these little resistances, are showing their humanity, showing their power. Just briefly, and my apologies for using the N-word, but to to use this next example, which is very interesting. I'm going to use the language of the plantation owners. There was the development of something in the late 1700s in relation to the destruction of the machinery of production. We see the slaves on a regular basis destroying the tools. They're digging in the field and accidentally come upon a rock, and oh no, the hoe is broken. Oh no, this tool or that tool is broken. You know, and you can't work for the rest of the day if you have no tools because they're all broken. So we see the development and the reaction of capital in something called the nigger hoe. And this was a 4-pound hoe, very similar to Woodman's axe, that was developed because they figured, well, if the slaves are breaking all these other tools, we're going to develop this big-ass hoe that there's no way they're going to be able to break. And, of course, we saw them destroying those as well. So we see this as a particular crisis within capital. You see that, you know, all the tools that the slaves are using are being destroyed, and the reaction of that is to is for capital to react and develop this, 4-pound hoe. And to quote, to lay out an example from Raymond and Alice Bayer in their article Day-to-Day Resistance to Slavery, which appeared in the Journal of Negro History, a very mainstream journal for this kind of subject. And to quote them, the nigger hoe was first introduced into Virginia as a substitute for the plow in breaking up the soil. The law fixes its right at 4 pounds, as heavy as a woodman's axe. The plantation the planters tell us, as the reason for its use, that the Negroes would break a Yankee hoe in pieces on the first root or stone that might be in their way. So we see, while this didn't free them from slavery, this didn't free them from their bonds, it did create space in which they could act. It did create some kind of liberatory space, and it shows their humanity and their development. And this continues. We see a massive theft under slavery of anything from grains and the pig sitting in the plantation owner's barn, to little items from the home, where different slave women were brought into the home as cooks or to clean the big house. You know, little trinkets and things found their way out. To continue, I think most people can understand theft. Also, we see this forming itself in the general revolt against work. We see, the Sambo concept of the slave. The Sambo is this lazy, good-for-nothing, stupid animal that we've enslaved for his own good. He can't work. We have to stand over him constantly to get him to work. There's a very good example. I was reading this diary of a slaveholder who described the fact that he'd be riding on his horse, and as soon as he approached one field of slaves, they would start working and really, you know, doing the job well. And then, you know, he'd look across the field, and the other field of slaves would be behind his back working very slowly. So we see these kind of things laid out very interestingly. And it's a disease the slaves had, and I apologize in my mispronunciation, but I'll do my best. Deistesia Ethiopica. And this is a disease that was found among slaves. And what this disease is the fact that that the slaves were unable to work and work slowly. This is a disease that that different doctors and plantation owners would say their slaves had. The refusing to work for someone in which you're getting absolutely no benefit, the refusal of being a slave, is a disease. And we see that even today. We see which we'll see later under peasant societies, the criminalization of communal behaviors. But it's very interesting to see all these different diseases and things developed for just the everyday resistance and the everyday exertion of people's humanity, which is something that is even brought up till today. Another common form is exodus, running away, forming their own communities. Especially in Brazil, it was a lot more common than here in the United States. The example of slave communities in Florida is one good one. There in Brazil, there were many, many maroon communities, many with as many as 1,000 to 3,000 slaves in them. They ran away and formed their own communities, very similar to those in Africa. You didn't see them mimicking, even though they had very, as generations passed, very little knowledge of their way of organizing in Africa. You see these slave communities in Brazil developing as very, very similar to those in Africa, even though they're many generations passed. So you see these communities developing. There's one specific community, which I like to call the legend and threat of Palmares. And I apologize for my pronunciation of Spanish. But the fugitive—it's a major fugitive community in Brazil. It existed for about 20 years, from 1723 to 1743, and this community had a major role just in the fact that it existed. You know, slaves couldn't organize themselves; they needed to be enslaved. They couldn't have their own societies. But here we see a beautiful example. Of that, and that was a very big draw to the slaves themselves. You see, even in the beginning of the French Revolution, or you see in the revolution in Haiti, just the fact that slaves are resisting, just the fact, give me one sec to finish this point, just the fact that, you know, you have a call for democracy, that all men are created equal, et cetera, you see that, you know, that cycling into the slaves' everyday resistance. You see them saying around the time of revolution to their slave masters while they're being whipped that all men are created equal. You know, and here's people who couldn't read or couldn't do this, who couldn't do that. You see the fact that many slaves are running away into these communities. You see slaves that would run away in a form of a strike, and they would run off into the woods, not too far from the plantation, and they would be fed and through the thievings or the excess food from different slaves, and they refused to come back until that conditions were improved. So you see these folks who absolutely have no education, who have absolutely, you know, quote unquote, are unable to organize themselves, who are formulating very interesting critiques. And in that, we see the slaves really did understand their situation. The slaves were well aware of their economic value and used it to a good advantage. The skilled laborers among the slaves knew their worth and frequently rebelled against unsatisfactory work conditions. Slaves who were hired would run away from the masters who had hired them and then return home or remain in hiding until they felt like returning to work. And that's also from Day-to-Day Resistance of Slavery, Raymond and Alice Bayer. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that there's a very good movie on Quilombo in Brazil. It's called Quilombo. It's about Palmares.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's excellent. You should check it out.
Thank you. Most definitely. Most definitely. If you can remind me at the end, because I definitely will not forget. Definitely will forget. And then just to continue a section I like to call The Roof, The Roof, The Roof Is On Fire. We don't need no water, let the motherfucker burn. Arson was a very, very common form of resistance in slave societies. Everything burned, from homes to barns to forests to anything they can get their hands on. It was a very, very common form. It was done completely in secrecy, of course. You know, no one was going to say, oh, by the way, I'm the arsonist. But this is something that we see really developing. And in another journal of a plantation owner, we see the expression and the real concern, oh my God, any one of them could be doing this. You know, there's a series of fires in Charleston. You see, you know, a couple of homes burn, a couple of barns burn, and they were so absolutely scared out of their wits for the fact that it could have been any number of these slaves. It was done completely in secret. And, you know, the comparison with the ELF and ALF, I think, is very interesting. You know, and does this resistance under slavery justify the ELF, ALF tactic? That's a question that needs to be explored. But we see these commonality of forms. Arson will continue as a common tactic in peasant societies. They're not happy with conditions and that not being fed enough, so, you know, they'll steal from the barn and then they'll burn it down. So you see these common forms. Another one is feigning of illness and pregnancy. You know, no slave owner wants a dead slave because it's no good to him. But if he's not feeling too well and he looks quite sick, he's not going to work that day. So feigning illness is a very common thing. And to show that it really was, their actual feigning of illness, and it wasn't just actually real illness that was written down as such, not us looking back at history, you know, slaves didn't work on Sundays. And it was very interesting that how many people were sick on Friday and Saturday but feeling great on Sunday. And that was a observation that came up over and over and over again in different journals of plantation owners. And you see these slaves who are not feeling well on Saturday, but bam, they're dancing around and having a good time come Sunday. And maybe even sick back on Monday. So just to cap off that, another form that was used, there was a very interesting occasion in 1807. And to quote, on at least one occasion in 1807 in Charleston, mass suicides occurred. In the case of two boatloads of newly arrived Negroes starved themselves to death. Infanticide was common, starving themselves to death, mutilation. There's a couple of really good examples, and you know, while that quote says, yes, there was one specific act of slaves starving themselves to death, is I've read more than a few different examples of a slave who put his arm on the chopping block and cut it off with an axe, knowing that he wouldn't have to work or would have to work less. So you see this absolute, almost desperation. Why I am not proposing a revolutionary strategy of cutting off our arms so we can't work, it's important to see these everyday resistances. So to move beyond that, to quote Public Enemy, our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Let me hear you say, fight the power. And one of the most important sections to me in the slave communities, in slave everyday resistance, is looking at the formation of communities. And this is straight up Kropotkin Mutual Aid. Yeah, not to quote Kropotkin, because I'm sure most folks have read him. But we see massive communication networks. We see many of the freedmen were literate and could get access to newspapers and could read them to the slaves. We see communication, things that are happening in France that slaves in Charleston, South Carolina are hearing, or in Georgia are hearing. And there's a slave rebellion in Georgia, and they're, you know, they hear about it, and they're calling to it, and they're rebelling in Florida or in other parts of the South or even in the North. And this is in reflection to a concept that was developed in Italy in the 70s called the cycle of struggle. And one rebellion leads to another. For instance, the good example of the nigger hoe. Here, we need the creation of all these new hoes, and there's no tools that can be used for the slaves, and you're forcing production in other places. Hoes need to be created, two new tools need to be created, and then you're, you know, demanding, you know, this. You're creating the need for tools, and you're forcing production in other areas. This everyday resistance to slavery, you see then someone's got to create these hoes, and they're being done in the factories of the North. And then you're pressing down on the workers in the North, saying, oh, come on, we need these hoes for the South. Come on, come on. We need to produce them. And then through that, you see the everyday resistance of workers in the North. And there's a couple of good cycles that are really well mapped out to show how the everyday resistance of slaves led to everyday resistance of industrial and social workers in the North. And that's not to say that there weren't slave rebellions. I'm proud to say that one of the first slave rebellions ever in the New World was in Long Island, my hometown. Glad that something radical happened there. But, and in a sense, these everyday resistance led to these overt rebellions. To kind of finish off with slavery, moving on to peasants, Herbert Apthecker, the historian, maps out 240 different overt slave rebellions. And they come very interestingly in cycles of about 8 to 12 years. So we see these different cycles happening. And very interesting enough, we see peaks around the time of the Haitian Revolution. Correct me if I'm wrong, 1793. I might be off by a couple of dates there. But you see the Haitian Revolution, and then you see everyday resistance exploding, and then you see the overt rebellion that's a reaction to that. And in a sense, the everyday resistance is not completely just there, so the fact that it's raw power, raw material to create overt rebellions, but as we've seen, they're creating these actual reactions in capital and the state. We see laws being developed that slaves can't be out after a certain amount of time. We see a very good example in what's called the grog shop, and that's a underground space within the cities as slaves started to be rented out to folks in the southern cities, in the fact that the slave owners were not getting enough, not making enough, their plantations were not profitable enough, too much costs in things that were being burned, too much costs in tools that were being produced, and in effect, there was a development within capital, a interesting crisis in which slave owners could almost no longer, it was a transition period where the slave owners had to start using some of the slaves in wage labor to make profit for them, not necessarily the slaves. So you see a development in there, and that's primarily from everyday resistance. It's not from overt rebellion. That's not from the abolitionist movement. And then you see the development of these grog shops in the cities where poor whites would come together with slaves and trade homemade liquor or trade things they stole, and you see this whole network developing. And then capital has to react to the state has to react to these grog shops, which they were never really too successful. And you see John Brown, a form of overt rebellion. He gets out there and he as a very interesting example of blacks and whites working together, poor whites and blacks working together to fight against slavery, fight against that system. That happened in the grog shops first, almost 20 years beforehand. So you see this development of relationships on an everyday basis between the slaves and between poor whites. And it's very interesting, not just in their everyday resistances. When they burned down homes, they didn't burn down homes of any white person they found. They burned down homes of those in positions of power, those who were in the patrols, were making sure that there was no, Negroes on the street. There were, they burned down the homes of their plantation owners, but poor white farmers, very interestingly, didn't have their homes burned down. And then in times where the slaves actually organized, there's about 200, as I said, 240 examples of this. They went on a rampage. They, stormed in the plantation owner. They killed him. They stole his guns. And in many instances, they're charging into town and, oh my God, they're shooting any white person they could find. And it's very interesting when you look at who those people they shot and who those people they killed, and they weren't poor whites. They were plantation owners. They really did understand the complexity of the social order that they were really attacking. They understood who was on their side and who wasn't. And this, I think, is, while this is old news, to Herbert Aufdecker, to a lot of folks who've studied this as part of the development of the Civil Rights era, and a lot of this came about because of the need of understanding slavery from that movement. And to move beyond that and to finish off and cap off slavery, there's been a lot of good work, Zinn by one, for one, and a number of other folks, looking at the Civil War, and interesting enough, these cycles of rebellion leading up to the Civil War didn't change. You didn't see a shortening of the cycle. It still stayed about 8 to 12 years. There was a couple of 6-year cycles between overt rebellions leading up to the Civil War, but really, for the most part, there's not really a change. But primarily looking at the crisis that was the Civil War, the fact that slavery was no longer a profitable system, that industrialization was the next logical step, a lot of the crisis was formed through the everyday resistance. These overt rebellions, in a sense, while they were interesting, we love to talk about John Brown, we love to talk about other folks, in a fact, that's the everyday resistance that really led to that crisis, to that struggle. And while also we're not happy with the conclusion of slaves becoming wage slaves, it still is a very interesting thing to look at.
Another really interesting historian, if you like this, if you're interested in sort of like more of the everyday resistance, is Leon Littwack. He wrote Trouble in Mind. He's not, I don't know if he's like an anarchist historian, but he's really amazing in detail. Trouble in Mind is about Reconstruction, but he's written many other books.
Definitely know that to me after as well. Since I've really spent a lot of time on slavery, and there is a reason for that, for the fact that the work that's been done around peasants and workers is not as clear. We can see American slavery is kind of a closed system. It has a start date, it has an end date, there's certain rebellions and certain everyday resistances. We can see the development, can lay it out. It's a lot more difficult in peasant societies for the fact, we see the peasant rebellions in the, when they're being enclosed inside a capital. We see resistance up to today, as Zapatistas are a good example. But looking at peasants as the autonomists do, as workers, however small their relation to capital. And that's done in three ways, either the peasants as wage workers, or unwaged in the case of the slaves, as tenants for landlords, or as producers for the market in the cases where money is exchanged. So we see peasants primarily as agricultural workers. They are workers. They're not some, class to be forged into workers. They're not some class to be ignored, but it's a very interesting, approach. And this is really coming out of, as I discussed before, an internal argument within Marxism and saying, well, Mao's analysis and Lenin's analysis of the peasants really wasn't sufficient. And a lot of the autonomists, especially this fellow James Scott, who's a Yale professor, Weapons of the Week, which I quoted from before, is outside. So if you're interested, pick that up. But we see a very interesting thing. There is a conceptual problem. in saying, you know, we can see specifically these everyday resistance and its specific effect within capital. But in peasants, unfortunately, that information has really not been developed. There's been a lot of work looking at peasants in a strong state or peasants under, state capital, peasants under Soviet Russia or peasants under China, their reaction to collectivization and their reaction to decollectivization. And there's a fellow, Daniel Kelleher, who comes out of the James Scott camp, in his discussion of everyday resistance to decollectivization. And it was the everyday resistance of peasants, as we know in China, overt rebellion is not suggested. In such a strong state that you have to, you know, peasants must be ideologically correct. They must, you know, obey certain ideological and other things. They, you know, have to produce a certain amount for the collective, for the state. So overt rebellion really became something that wasn't really able to, you know, to these peasants. It wasn't something they were able to do on a regular basis. They couldn't form organizations. So a lot of that resistance fell into the everyday resistance category. And through a lot of that everyday resistance, and you'll have to trust me on this, since we're closing out on time, the everyday resistance really challenged the collectivization. And actually, there came a point where the collectivization was impossible. Even though it was, in theory, all these peasants were collectivized, they were carving off their own little plots of land. They were not reporting, you know, certain grains. They were giving, we're giving you 10 pounds of grain, but really only handing you 5. So all these little resistances really ate away at the system and came to the point where, quote-unquote, collectivization could no longer function. And then you see the process of decollectivization, which is the privatization of these collective farms, and you see the peasants' reaction to that because they didn't want that either. So while the peasants, primarily in this case and in others, in Vietnam is another example of a peasant's reaction to a strong state or to Soviet Union. While the peasants, in a sense, unlike in slavery, really had some specific reaction to the capitalist system. They really ate away at the strong state. They ate away at capital. And those eating away, why, in a sense, they didn't prevent a lot of the plans, the planned economy, the Green Revolution, other things for them. You saw a lot of those planes being diverted and the ability to create some kind of space within that. And then also in time, very often creating crises within capital. But to move very quickly, and I apologize for not touching on the issue of gender because that's almost a whole other presentation. We see the attack on the machine, the machines of production. For instance, batteries were removed from the machines and thrown into irrigation ditches. Carburetors and other valid parts such as the distributors and air filters were smashed. Sand and mud were put in the gas tank and various objects, stones, wires, nails were thrown into the augers. Starting in 1976, we see when carbine harvesting began with a vengeance. Peasant acts of vandalism likewise spread throughout the paddy growing region. And that's the quote, James Scott's Weapons of the Week again. That's going on in Malaysia in a small town in which the Green Revolution we saw in the 70s was really being implemented in these communities. We see what's development, capital forcing what's called double cropping. Normally in the rice paddies, they're producing one crop a year, and the implementation of the Green Revolution forced this double cropping. And you see the reaction to the double cropping, because really what it is, which I'll get to later, is the imposition of work, the endless imposition of work. And we're not getting enough out of one crop, we need two crops, and of course, you know, as we know, that the peasants are not being paid more or being compensated more for growing two crops. So you see the resistance to this, you see the resistance to the speeding up of work, you see the resistance to the machinery as not only destroying their way of life, but imposing work upon them. Theft, another good example. Grains were taken from barns, fish were taken from ponds, fruit trees were cut down, and that, interestingly enough, is from Everyday Forms of Peasant Resistance. And actually, I believe that was in Poland in the 1850s. So we see throughout history these different forms arising. The strike arising in a very, you know, quote-unquote unorganized, informal strike, where peasant women would just be known throughout the community that they were not going to work until they got more money on this certain plantation. And in a sense, yes, it's a sense of organizing. And that really teeters, I guess you would say, the fence between the Everyday Resistance and the Overt Rebellion, when I discuss models briefly, you'll see that it's not some kind of gradation, but there's actually a more interesting relationship between the two. We see here also the outright refusal to work. We see the carving up of space of, well, you know, it's taking a lot more time to, you know, shake this patty. We see Exodus, the ultimate form of peasant passive resistance, which I really don't consider as passive, but I'll quote it anyway, was to run away. And we see peasants that would refuse to work on this plantation or refuse to work at this landlord's property and go work on another. And in a sense, the shifting of labor, you know, allow them to create some kind of space and some kind of demands. Squatting, very interesting enough, we see that taking a lot of different forms, anywhere from during the Nicaraguan Revolution to, in Peru, another good example, in 1947. We see that in the formation of the peasant, you know, the formation of capital in the German peasant wars, a very common tactic used. Arson, once again, shows its ugly head and becomes a very common tactic for peasants throughout history. Murder, often a primary weapon used by peasants, was direct physical, often murderous attack. Assassinations of local officials and notables unsettled many landlords and other members of the elite. To touch on very briefly, also something that's developed within the peasantry, a very interesting formulation that was created by James Scott, is called symbolic action. You see, very interesting in the peasants and continually in all forms of capital and workers' reaction to it. Symbolic action, the simple coordination, the symbol, you know, me and Josh here are sitting and Frank's our boss and we're creating rumor and talking shit about him. You see a lot of this as really a base for other forms of everyday resistance, you know. We see that as a base for communication, the symbolic action of, you know, wouldn't it be great to burn down his, you know, his barn. And even though we don't do it, that kind of rumor being spread actually creates these kind of everyday resistances, as well as overt rebellion. Moving on really quickly, I want to discuss the issue of mutual aid, community, and communication. Also, Mexican institutions, we see that the Zapatistas are really building upon are communal institutions that have existed in that area of the world for quite some time. And I'd also like to touch on briefly, which comes up very nicely in an article by Peter Limbaugh, in reaction to a series of articles that Marx wrote in 1842, before he did the manuscripts. I won't try to pronounce the German paper he wrote for. If someone else can help me out, I see you smiling. Do you know the name of the paper that he wrote for in 42? Yes, thank you. Marx wrote a series of five different articles in relation to forest crimes. The peasants in that section of Germany had naturally been going out to the forests and collecting dead wood and collecting mushrooms and collecting trees from the fruit, berries from the bushes. Fruit from the trees, not from trees from the fruit, excuse me. But... but you see these everyday forms of their organization. This is how they live their lives. And in the implementation of scientific forestry, you see the implementation of land rights, of property being forced upon these communities. And what happens is these communal behaviors are being criminalized. And in a lot of ways, this article and a lot of other work that both Marx and Limbaugh has done has reflected this. Crime is primarily in our society, vestigial communal behaviors, forms of resistance. And that reflects very interestingly in the rise of the prison industrial complex. You know, I've seen a lot of folks speaking about, well, you know, we had all these, you know, black liberation movements and other movements of the 60s, and the prison industrial complex is a reaction to that. Well, it's a reaction to a lot more than that. It's a reaction to what's really happening in the communities. These forms of survival, you know, if you're living in a community, in a poor community, and you can only sell drugs, in a sense, it's a form of survival. It's criminalized behaviors, criminalized vestigial communal behaviors. We see it in the behavior of these peasants and going out and taking wood. Well, you're no longer allowed to do what you've been doing for thousands of years. You know, it's criminalized in the form of these forms of crimes that continually and develop are almost, you know, you have to make the looking at the formation of the state and capitalism, the early formation, they have to criminalize these behaviors. You have to be punished for doing what you've done for thousands of generations. So in a sense, the everyday resistances, and I'd go as bold to say, even today, are vestigial communal behaviors. You know, mutual aid, solidarity, a lot of these other things, creating space outside of capital, you know, sneaking out in a field to create my own vegetables, you know, where they can't find them, you know, if I'm an agricultural worker. These are really interesting formulations, and I'm really rushing to get through this. I was going to quote something, but I won't. Okay. Moving on to social and industrial workers. Against this monster, people all over the world, in particular ordinary and working people in factories, mines, fields, and offices, are rebelling every day in ways of their own invention. And that's a quote from C.L.R. James, Facing Reality. And for all those anarchists, for all us anarchists out there, I think it's very important for us to start approaching a lot of these formulations that have been done by autonomous Marxists, by folks like C.L.R. James, in really addressing the concerns and concepts he develops within our own action. But briefly, to describe the social factory as a good example is husband as boss. The home is the social factory. You're producing, women are, through their own bodies, producing workers. Women through their own activities in making sure that dinner is on the table by the time the husband gets home and the children are cleaned are creating workers. You're recreating that worker to go back to work the next day. Through your body, as I mentioned, through your own actions, women's work as unwaged work. And there was a movement developed around the world called Wages for Housework in the 70s, 60s and 70s, around an article by Mary Rosa de la Costa, Women in the Subversion of the Community, and how women's work is not being waged, on how slavery to an assembly line is not liberation from slavery to a kitchen sink. So we're seeing these as different forms of work. Another really great form of work, and I'm glad to see that this is something that's being put out there lately, is the school. School is factory. School is prison. School is work. You're creating yourself as a worker. You're creating yourself as a, you know, dependable, someone who's on time, who when that bell rings, I'm sure it'll ring shortly, we'll all move on to the next workshop. You know, and hopefully we can sit here and resist that. Because I'm not done yet. But also every worker wears shoes. Sabotage. Very, very common form of resistance. I don't think I even need to address that. Self-activity in the zoot suits. We see the development within the African-American community even before the civil rights era of the zoot suits. Zoot suit was a rebellion against material that was banned during World War II. The material that they used to make their zoot suits was banned. It was illegal to have a zoot suit. It was illegal to walk around with a zoot suit. And additionally, you see these zoot suits in relation to young black males creating a fast-paced improvisational language that sharply contrasted with a passive stereotype of the stuttering, tongue-tied Sambo. And whereas white community commonly addressed them as boy, zoot suiters made the fetish of calling each other man. So you see these everyday resistances very, very interestingly in this community. And also, I'd like to mention the Birmingham bus boycotts, and Rosa Parks loves to get awards, and I give that woman a hell of a lot of credit. But what she was is the end of a struggle, not the beginning. We see since as early as September 1941, there were at least 88 cases of blacks occupying white space on public transportation, 55 of which were open acts of defiance, which African-American passengers either refused to give up their seats or sat in the white section. But this is only part of the story. Reported incidents and complaints of racial conflict totaled 175. That's a 12-month period. That's a year from September 1941 to September 1942. The cases have included at least 18 interracial fights among passengers, 22 fights between black passengers and operators that included 13 incidents in which black passengers engaged in verbal or physical confrontation over being shortchanged. So we see this Rosa Parks getting on the bus is something that thousands and thousands of women had done up to that point. And it's very interesting that Rosa Parks was used because it was primarily the African-American women who were using those buses. And you see this struggle as something that women have been going on every day. And that women would create, buddy systems because, they wouldn't be raped or attacked by whites. And we see rape as, not just a method of war, but a method of dominating women throughout history. And there was many different ways in which women try to counteract that. A lot of times, slave and peasant women, and even, within the factory and social factory, you see women hiding their daughters. In a sense, a way of protecting them, of not having to go through what they did. You see a lot of women in slave and peasant societies, their name's not being registered. These are women who don't exist. These are women who are being hidden away from society. So in a sense of protecting them. And you see those women, you know, it wasn't in a sense of, you know, of a paternalistic, you know, protection of their daughters. In a sense, they were creating space for their daughters to live in and actually functioning. We see the strike slow down and shut down as a common form. And I'm not talking strike in the fact of an organized labor. In a sense, in the Hungarian Revolution, we see in 1956 many different general strikes being organized, and it was done against the union. It was done against these forms of organizing. And then out of these general strikes, we see the formulation of workers' councils, very democratic forms that existed within the factory that communicated with other worker councils and other factories. And while there's problems with that, we see that as it developed out of the everyday resistances. We see counterplanning on the shop floor, which I think is the real key to discussing. Counterplanting also existed in Social Factory, but I'll leave the translation up to you folks. But counterplanting, for example, in one department of a certain plant in the United States, there is a worker who is physically incapable of carrying out his duties, but he's a man with a wife and children, and his condition is due to the previous strain of his work in the plant. The workers in that department have organized their work so that for nearly 10 years he has nothing, practically nothing to do. They have defied all efforts of the foreman and supervisor to discharge him, threatened to throw the whole plant into disorder if any steps are taken to dismiss the invalid. That is the socialist society. That's the quote, C.L.R. James in his Facing Reality once again. But you see this counterplanning. You know, there's a lot of good examples of workers just creating their own work day. You see... Yeah, let me finish.
Yeah, just briefly, Jeremy, I think it's Belcher of Bircher's book, Strike, is a good example of that. The Wildcats in the 70s.
That's my next 60, point.
Yeah, in the auto plants. I mean, literally, I mean, they just pretty much organized their own
themselves.
Factory.
And while that really came out, that was a development of overt rebellion out of everyday resistance. But we see this counterplanning is really being successful. You know, workers who would accidentally, you know, break an engine because then that engine would have to go through an inspection. They all sit around and figure out for 2 hours what's wrong with that engine. But they all knew. So, you know, Wildcat strikes, as Frank mentioned, is very interesting because Wildcat strikes are strikes against the union. They're strikes against the management of labor by the unions. Unions are outdated, and I hope there's no IWW people that'll throw things at me in this room. But unions are outdated modes of struggle. They have been since 1956. They have been since they've been incorporated inside capitalism. And part of my call today is to form new strategies and new modes of organization. To just run through them, we see workers, exodus, human migration, mass migration. We see squatting. We see arson. We see murder. We see symbolic action. We see actions against the union all throughout the social industrial factory. You see mutual aid communication and community being developed. You know, the grog shops existed within the 1940s and 50s in African-American communities. These were places of leisure that allowed freer expression, particularly for women whose sexuality was often circumscribed to by employer family members and the law and the fear of sexual assault in society with free protections for black women. We see these community spaces being created. We see communication happening. We see the church turned into a space for community activity. To continue, to discuss the changes, the particular crisis in capitalism in the industrial and social factory are pretty interesting. We see women coming into the workplace, and in a sense, to lay out very briefly, this is how much work capitalism needed. This is how many workers they had, and they were all male. They needed to fill this space with women. You know, we see a very interesting development of women going into the workplace as capitalism need them, and then you see women revolting in that workplace. You see the development of women's movements and things in relation to capital. But to really go into the issue of a general crisis, that means a crisis of the form of capitalism, we would have to turn, unfortunately, to the other side since nothing has been done on ours, and look at Crisis of Democracy by Samuel Huntington. He's an author and writer for the Trilateral Commission, obviously not part of our crew. say the very least. But you know, a lot of what he discusses in that is a crisis of democracy. And what that is the movements of the 60s saying that we want a participation in our own society. And that's done not through just overt rebellion, through demanding of rights, through demanding of other things, but also through everyday resistance. And we see ways to counteract that. You know, defund the schools, get rid of welfare, you know, enslave people. And we see the rise of information production, and informationalization of capital, in relation to overt rebellion as well as everyday resistance. And look at, you know, the tip of the iceberg example, in the sense of that these overt rebellions, the things that are happening, are really tip of the iceberg for what's really going on in society. So we see the common forms. We see destruction of tools, theft, exodus, arson, strike, feigning illness, slowdown, suicide. All these forms are going throughout peasant societies, slave societies, and in industrial and social factories. So commonality of forms. This is something that hasn't been done before. This is something that I've been working on and putting forth. But also I come to very similar conclusions as the autonomists. And that's my next call. My next call is to say that there's been a lot of interesting developments in the Marxist community, C.L.R. James, all the way through Tony Negri. And we see that just with the amount of anarchists who are reading Empire. Raise your hand if you've read Empire or familiar with Empire.
Someone recommended it to me yesterday.
Read Empire. It's good stuff. While there's problems with it, we see the connection.
Written by
Tony Negri and Michael Hart. It's now soft cover, so you won't have to pay $35 to get a hold of it. Very interesting book.